Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and you're very welcome to this week's podcast, The Siege of Kinsale, also known as the Battle of Kinsale. It was the ultimate battle in England's conquest of Gaelic Ireland, and it all started in October 1601. I went to Kinsale to find out more about this battle, and I met John Toolier, a local historian, and we travelled to James's Fort, and that's where it all started.
We are standing here on what is now James Fort, was then Castle Park Castle. Strategically, as you can see yourself, we're looking facing north, overlooking the harbour of Kinsale. You see there, tucked away in the northwestern corner of the harbour, the town of Kinsale. And then this ridge, this very, very significant topographical feature, which starts at the eastern end of the moat of the harbour and works its way right around the back of the town as we're looking at it. And it was to this point, approximately halfway through the siege of Kinsale, that the Lord Deputy Mountjoy, the commander of the English forces in Ireland, came from his camp across the harbour on the high ground over to this particular point. Having taken back the harbour, he then wished to proceed with the second phase of the siege, which was how best he might further invest the town where the Spaniards had come approximately a month prior to this again. Now, we're standing here, we're looking down on the middle harbour of Kinsale. And Kinsale town, back in the 16th century, would have consisted, the main thoroughfares which we travel through today and walk on, were in fact open parts of the inner harbour, through which ships sailed and so on like that. Cargoes were just landed and discharged and handled on the quaysides there. Kinsale, therefore, was an extremely important port on the south coast of Ireland. And it has these two fantastic features which are very significant in terms of any fort, of any port, and that is the ability to provide shelter and have deep water, which must have been extremely attractive to any visiting or foreign ships. The town itself consisted of a population of 2,000 people, and it would have been considered as one of 13 country towns in Ireland at the time, coming after such larger areas as Waterford, Limerick, Galway, and they in turn coming after Dublin, which had a population of just 5,000 in those days. So we can see that Kinsale would have been a significant port in those days.
So the siege of Kinsale begins.
Don Juan de Aquila, the Spanish commander in the town, General Mountjoy, Lord Mountjoy, Lord Deputy, on the camp hill, on the hill, overlooking the town. Mountjoy decides to begin the siege. Not in any sort of direct confrontational way, but in a very sort of a gradual method of dealing with the Spaniards. And so his approach is to win back the outposts. To win back the harbour was terribly important for him, as he saw. And he was prepared to wait and leave the Spaniards, you know, starve, if you like, in the town and gradually wear them down in that way. So to kind of very gently, if you like, almost win back the various different outposts was his first move. And he moved, first of all, towards Rincorn Castle, where today Charles Fort is located. And he decided to take that as being his first project, if you like, in winning back for himself. And he appointed George Carew. George was the Lord President of Munster. And George was sent over there to at least neutralise the Spaniards within Rincon, because, as I said, it was very convenient to forbid our ships. And Carew, we're told, he did score out his ground markers so that the want of light was no hindrance. In other words, that he could begin a process of bombardment of Rincon Castle, which could go on 24 hours a day, right through the night. Now, the defence was conducted by Bartholomew Clavigo, this young Spanish ensign, who displayed, in my opinion, tremendous courage. You know, was prepared to be spurred and buried in the ruins of Rincon, and withstood and withheld there for 4 days of constant battering by the Lord President. Eventually, however, he was obliged, in fact, almost by his own men, because they began to mutiny within the castle, that he decided to, that he had to surrender. And they were actually given very, very good terms by Carew. In fact, brought back to Cork and shipped out of Cork back to Spain. Of course, the attitude there was that if Carew was seen to be showing such clemency to the people at Rincon, that maybe the other 3,000 or so Spanish soldiers in the town would quickly succumb to his gesture and surrender. But that didn't happen. Having taken over Rincon, the English attention now is attracted across the harbour here to the location we're on, Castle Park. Mm-hmm. And Castle Park was, again, as you can see, dominating the harbour and the town here like this. And we are told that, for instance, ships which had arrived from England with reinforcements bombarded the castle here. The ships failed to take the castle. There was the use of a sow, for instance. The sow was a wooden structure that could be moved up to the walls, and people underneath, with the protection of the sow, with the roof of the sow, would work with pick and axes to try and undermine the walls and so on like that. So the English have tried to apply this machine, as it was called, to undermine the walls of the castle. However, we are told here that the engine, not being big enough, and they within the walls, that's the Spaniards, having a large store of great stones on the top, tumbled them down and broke it. And as a result, the English failed at that. But, however, it was won back. Actually, a huge effort was put in to commemorate the coronation of the Queen, the anniversary of her coronation. And eventually, on the 20th of November, Castle Park Castle was won back. And so the harbour, at least the outlying posts, were made available back to in English hands. The harbour was in the control of the English, and it was at this point, on the 20th of November, that Mountjoy came over across from his camp in Camphill to see and look back on the town and examine how best it might be further invested and besieged.
So all the outposts have been taken back by the English, and now Mountjoy's focus is on getting the town of Kinsale.
So he put guns, he immediately established guns, for instance, at Silly Point. That's the little peninsula there sticking out across the harbour, very, very close to the town. He also organised ships in the harbour to constantly bombard the town, you know. But some of the descriptions in the earlier records and so on like that, of the viciousness of the attack and what happened and so on like that, in the various different phases of it, are absolutely amazing. And, you know, where we're here, it's rather cold and objective and detached and a bit scholarly, if you like, in terms of trying to describe what happened. The pain and the suffering, at a time when the winter was approaching and so on like that, Spaniards, for instance, far removed from certainly far warmer climates and so on like that, in hostile surroundings where they were apparently getting little or no support despite all the promises from the Irish and so on like that. And here a very, very aggressive English commander, you know, constantly pounding them left, right and centre. So you had the establishment of the first battery. There was a second battery established even closer to the town. Just, we're told, 250 paces from Cork Gate, a relatively small part. Some of the Irish, the leading Irish families, the O'Briens, the Thomans, for instance, came to the assistance of Mountjoy. The Clanrickard, the Burkes of Galway and so on, they also supported them. So, you know, the Spanish within the town must be beginning to feel very, very isolated. But despite that constant bombardment and so on like that, I think something that isn't often acknowledged from the Spanish point of view is the fact of how brave and how dedicated they were to their job. We're told, for instance, that after 10 days of constant bombardment at the beginning of December, a trumpeter was sent by the English to see if the Spaniards would surrender in the town. And the message sent back by the Spaniards was that they held the town for God and for the King of Spain. Contra tutti inimici, against all enemies.
So, John, what is the next stage?
The next stage now is to go from Castle Park Castle to Camp Hill, the English camp.
So here we are on the site of Camp Hill.
While we've been speaking an awful lot about the success of the English in terms of the siege and how well, you know, they were investing in the town and so on like that, the English also suffered very considerably. For 2 month period, they were in a very exposed area. And where they had got very successfully reinforcements in from Bristol, Barnstable, Cork, Dublin and so on like that, in fact, it's estimated at one stage that their camp, the size of the English army in the Kinsale area was something like 12,000 people, which is a huge number when you think of the area that we're in and then for them to be accommodated and so on like that. But that 12,000 may have been the case in terms of actual numbers of English bodies or people supporting the English side in Kinsale. We are also told that something like 40 per day were dying of camp diseases, dysentery and various different associated problems. Here we are in you know, this time of the year. One can assume with the cold and so on like that, that many, many more of them were dying and suffering. So that when we speak about 12,000, a total complement of 12,000, can reduce that to something in the region of 6,000 effective soldiers operating here. So that's one side of it.
The siege on Kinsale town is now 2 months in, and the Spaniards are getting desperate and need to get help quickly from their allies, the Irish chieftains in the north.
The situation for the Spaniards was getting very, very drastic. And immediately the Spaniards arrived here in September, they immediately sent notice to their chieftains in the north that they had arrived. And the chieftains were made aware very, very early on that their allies, the Spaniards, had eventually arrived in Kinsale. We spoke about the various different constraints that were being imposed that had been organised by Mountjoy on the Irish chieftains, which confined them very, very much to the north. But eventually pressure came on to the point that on the 24th of October, Red Hugh O'Donnell decided that he would leave the north, gather as many of his clan's people as he possibly could, and allies such as the McSweeneys, the O'Rourkes, the O'Dohertys, and march south to Kinsale. They left from Ballymote in County Sligo. He had already been suffering to the extent that his own base, he had left Donegal. But gathered his people at Ballymote and marched south, passing very close to Boyle, Elphin, and eventually crossing the River Shannon at Shannon Harbour. There, in Offaly, he encountered some resistance but eventually took up camp at Templemore in County Tipperary. And there he awaited the arrival of O'Neill, whom he expected to leave the north very soon after himself. He waited on there for 3 weeks. The English at Kinsale, Mountjoy, very soon discovered that the Irish O'Donnell had set out from the north, and he immediately sent the Lord President George Carew to intercept this force of O'Donnell's coming from the north. Carew expected O'Donnell to come east of the river shore, which would be the more natural, normal way to come south. So Carew marched from Kinsale and encamped just north of Cashel, close to Holy Cross Abbey, and there awaited the arrival of O'Donnell. O'Donnell, however, after 3 weeks, decided he had to make the move. And in a very bold, brave march across the Slieveilm Mountain, in the middle of winter, on a very, very frosty, where the marsh conditions had frozen over for the night, managed a very epic march of 40 miles and avoided Carew's English army. From there, O'Donnell marched west, not directly to Cork at all, marched west around the Slieveilm Mountain and eventually ended up just west of Inishannon. And there he awaited the arrival of O'Neill. Now, O'Neill set out approximately a week after O'Donnell from Loch Raymer on the Cavan border. And there he marched south through Offaly, Leaks, and on into Tipperary, and from there followed a very similar route to O'Donnell's. The two groups rendezvoused eventually just west of Inishannon on the 5th of December, 1601. And there awaited, and very, very soon, were joined by 200 Spaniards who had landed at Castlehaven under General Ocampo. And there the Irish were joined by this group of Spaniards. And from Inishannon, they moved eventually to Kinsale. Camping, as we look north here from Camp Hill, we see the next sort of a valley-like depression, and then the next ridge to the north, 3 miles to the north of us, is Coolcarn. And there the Irish encamped on the 21st of December. So on the 21st of December, 1601, the Irish, consisting of O'Donnell, O'Neill and Ocampo, arrived and set up camp at Coolcarn, 3 miles to the north of us. This was 4 days before the Battle of Kinsale itself.
So what plan did the Irish have?
They had a very definite plan. At least from what we can gather of the records, there was a plan. They were divided in three sections, which would have been typical of any army on the move at the time. There was the vanguard, the leading section, and that was led by Richard Tyrrell. Richard had joined O'Neill on the way down, and he led the vanguard with Ocampo's 200 Spaniards. The main section, the main battle, was headed up by Hugh O'Neill, and the rear guard was taken by Red Hugh O'Donnell. They set out, I would imagine, approximately 5:30 on the morning of the 24th of December. And they moved through from their camp at Coolcarn through to Ballintubber, and on from Ballintubber onto Ballyregan. And at Ballyregan Cross, for one reason or another, and one doesn't know exactly what precisely was the cause of it, but O'Donnell's rear guard became detached from the main battle, and he took a route which took him away to the west of the march that O'Donnell and Tyrrell were taking. So at this point, I think it would be best if we left the English camp here, but travelled along this hillside a little bit further to Ardmartin.
So we're moving over to Ardmartin now.
Where we will see and be in a better position to describe the remainder of the Irish advance towards Kinsale.
Now, over here in Ardmartin, there's a dip in the valley, and this is where the actual battle took place.
Yes, further to the west of us here, the hill, this hill that surrounds Kinsale, on which the English camp was located, and on where we're standing now at Ardmartin, there the land dips away to ordinary ground level at Milewater, just to the west of us. And we're looking back up north there, and we're imagining the Irish in its three sections arriving in, with O'Donnell getting lost to the west or moving off to the west, taking a different route altogether. And we see, we can imagine the Irish forces coming, the Irish army coming towards this particular point, because that was the plan. The intention was that the two sections, O'Neill's section and O'Donnell's section, would come up onto the hill. They would be on roughly the same level as the English camp, and the intention was that they would advance directly towards the English camp and attack it at Camp Hill. The result of the whole thing, in essence though, was that the plan which had been worked out was now changed. And in my opinion, this was the turning point as far as the Battle of Kinsale was concerned. O'Neill, up to this point, had been extremely careful and cautious. He was now forced into a situation where some of his forces were missing for the time being. He had to change his strategy with regard to the Tyrrell's section and the Spaniards joining the Spaniards in the town. And the plan, as envisaged, has now radically changed. He had no option but to retire and to take up another position at Milewater. So let's now head off to the battle site.
So John, we have come across now and we're at the actual battle site, which is known as Milewater.
As O'Neill and Tyrrell's forces came back down off the hill here, O'Neill indicated that Tyrrell should remain approximately at this point, as we say, on the Kinsale side of the Mona Clarig River. And he remained here with his 200 Spaniards. O'Neill continued on across in this direction here, crossing the Benlamona stream, and on out there on the road that would take us eventually to Dundara. The English had very early realised what the Irish were doing, that they were retreating off down here to the west. And Mountjoy also had his planning done. Marshal Wingfield, he put in charge of the operations in the field. George Carew, whom we have encountered on several occasions as part of the siege, he left in the camp at Camp Hill to maintain, in fact, the majority of the forces. Of the 6,000 effective, he allocated approximately 1,200, only 1,200, to deal with the battle. And they were put in the charge of Marshal Wingfield. Other names, big names that came into the encounter on the English side were Sir Henry Power. Henry Power was put in charge of what was known as a squadron volant. There was a Henry Folliot who was engaged. We had a Captain Danver. Captain Danver was in charge of cavalry and so on like that. And finally, the other major English personality, if you like, on the English side, was Oliver St. John. Now, let's try to describe the situation as it was that morning. We have O'Neill fleeing, moving off further to the west, looking for firmer ground. Tyrrell, approximately here, where we're located at the moment. O'Neill's main battle being followed very, very closely by a group of English cavalry under Captain Denver. And as they go further west here, and as O'Neill began to rise up on the higher ground across the valley there from the Ballinamona stream, O'Donnell's forces, who had been lost for about 2 hours, suddenly appeared from the west and moving towards Kinsale here, moving, if you like, in the opposite direction to O'Neill. And fortuitously, even though, you know, he was lost, he had the effect of driving back that English cavalry under Captain Denver, which had been following up O'Neill. That left O'Neill at a stage where he could now have decide where he might actually finally locate his battle. And in fact, what he did is he came back again, but seeking firmer ground on the far side of the Ballinamona, and came approximately back onto those, that higher ground that we're looking at across the way there, like that. And Tyrrell, we must remember, is still in this particular position here, like this. More English followed on, and they followed through after O'Neill, and eventually where O'Neill faces west with his back in towards Kinsale, the English forces under Folio and under Henry Power are facing him on the far bank of the Ballinamona stream. In the meantime, what's happened to O'Donnell? O'Donnell had the effect of driving back the English cavalry, but when his cavalry, when his horse reorganized, they turned, unfortunately, back on their own foot soldiers following after the cavalry. And this had a traumatic effect, a very unfortunate effect on the foot soldiers, in that O'Donnell's horse going back onto his own foot created panic. And between one thing and another, they just scattered away off to the west, and that was the end of O'Donnell's participation in the battle. He eventually got back to Castlehaven and there joined Spanish ships and ended up back in Spain. You have O'Neill over here on that bank forming himself into a very formal type of battle arrangement, which was completely out of character with what he had been used to. It was always suggested, and O'Neill himself, certainly all the indications are, that to be successful, to be ultimately successful, he would have to meet in a battle in the open field. He would have to meet the English in open field situation. Here at Kinsale was the first opportunity that he had of doing that. And unfortunately, whether due to the pressure that was put on him by the change of plan at Ardmartin or whatever, it would appear that ultimately he was not successful. Several English charges were made at his formation and withstood. The English retired. It happened 2-3 times. Folliot and Power both made charges. Eventually, some of the English came down from the hill on the far side of Ballinamona there, crossed back across Ballinamona and began to attack O'Neill's forces in the flank. And the outside of the defence, the very formal defence system that was there, began to break up. And as that broke up, more and more of his soldiers disappeared off to the west and fled off in that direction. eventually becoming a road. Tyrrell and Ocampo realised what was happening and moved to join the main battle, moved to join O'Neill's battle. Again, put up a strong resistance, particularly the Spaniards under Ocampo. They were noted for the great stand they made here at Milewater. But eventually, through the sheer dint of the pressure from a well-organised English cavalry in particular, the O'Tyrrell fled, and very soon the Spaniards surrendered. The English were very, very effective, particularly effective cavalry. There they came, their cavalrymen were in saddles, they carried their spears at hip level, much, much more control than the Irish, who on horse tended to ride without saddle, tended to use the spears in an overarm action as distinct from a more controlled action at hip level and so on. And in various different ways, the training which O'Neill had tried to impose on the Irish was shown up for its lack of ability to penetrate and to work in the formal situation. Worked very, very well in the more hit-and-run, skirmish-type guerrilla activity, which had been very, very successful from 1595. But when it came to the formal battle situation of Kinsale 1601, it was seen to be not adequate for the job.
What happened to O'Neill after the battle?
O'Neill was a devastated man. And in the middle of winter, just to reinforce the misery of his situation, on crossing back over the Blackwater in Cork and eventually the Moy as he approached home in the north, many of his men were drowned in crossing that, adding to the misery and so on like that. But he was a devastated man. The old aspiration, that old idea that he had of a unified notion of an emerging, which was emerging all throughout Europe, the notion of a nationhood and so on like that, that was gone, totally gone. Very soon after that, in 1604, just before, around the time that Elizabeth died, he sat with Mountjoy and they drew up the Treaty of Mellifont. At that, O'Neill actually gained had restored to him many of the privileges that he had as Earl of Tyrone and as chieftain of the O'Neills. But at that stage, it had gone too far. The question of language, customs, culture, ownership of land, the payback time was there for the people who had put up the money to send the forces to Ireland. The need for land for plantation and so on like that was required. And more pressure was put on O'Neill to the point that in 1607, when he and his family were offered berths on a vessel sailing out of Lough Swilly, he boarded it along with the remainder of the O'Donnells and the Maguires and sailed for Brest in France. And there, the flight of the Earls. There the Earls, the families who had resisted the Tudor process, the Tudor colonisation, taking over of the country, came to an end. O'Neill went from France through to Rome and was fated all the way through on his way there, and eventually reached Rome and died there in 1616.
You've been listening to John Toolier, local historian from Kinsale. The recording was made in 2004, and a full version of this recording is available on Irish Life and Lore. I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and thank you for listening.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.